Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Today is Charlie White's birthday. So Charlie, how could we not be doing early modern today on your birthday?
Oh, it's all I asked for my birthday, so thank you. It's wonderful.
Yes, it is. So who's here? Who's here?
Well, we've got Stephanie Kosak today. She is an Associate Professor of History at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, across the pond. Her work has explored how the expanding sphere of commercial print, both visual and textual, impacted royalism and the representation of the monarchy in England between the mid-17th, greatest century known to man, and mid-18th. Her new research explores the history of loss, grief, gender, and material culture in England in the long 18th century. And this is all so fascinating. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you guys?
I have to, guys, did we find Stephanie via Carolyn? It sounds like we might have done.
I'm sure that you did.
Yeah. Yay for Carolyn, who has been fixing us up with all kinds of amazing historians in the amazing Carolinas the last few weeks. She's basically our History Hack pimp.
She's a perfect role for it. She's amazing. She knows everybody, I think. She's really plugged into these networks.
Yes, and very convincing as well. Like, I don't think if she wants you to do it, there's not really a, nah. Somehow you'll end up agreeing and you won't know how it happened. But this is going to be brilliant. And Charlie, go on, you can start. It's your birthday.
Oh, this is just so good. Go, Charlie. It's your birthday. Stephanie, your book opens up in what feels like a really odd place to start a discussion about reverence towards the monarch, because you start by discussing the execution of Charles I. What was the reason behind that particular choice?
Yeah, thanks. I kind of address this in the book too. I sort of say this is a weird place to begin with the execution of the monarch. But so one of the big questions my book is asking is how did sort of like attitudes toward rulers, how did relationships between subjects and sovereigns sort of change with the expansion of the print marketplace, especially graphic images in the 17th century? And I could think of no more sort of iconic image of the Stuart monarchy than the frontispiece to the Icon Basilica, which is the Charles the First sort of book, is like confession, right? Written just before and then published just around the regicide, which becomes this like best-selling sort of popular text of the 17th and 18th centuries, and has this sort of fold-out frontispiece engraved by William Marshall, who's the sort of most prolific engraver in Carolyn, England. And so I started this project like a million years ago. So I started it, I think it was in 2008 when I was in graduate school, or maybe it was 2007. And that was the sort of Obama election year. I don't know if you guys remember.
Yes, remember it well.
Yeah.
And we're both election junkies. We both sat up all night.
Yeah, same. Yeah, we all, especially in Indiana, we were just so excited. But so that iconic, you know, 2007, 2008 Hope poster, I don't know if you remember it, that poster of Obama, that was really, because I was just really fascinated by how that poster became this really kind of dominant image that was then like recycled and parodied and satirized. And I think that's the thing that really got me thinking about the Icon Basilica and the sort of image of monarchy it was presenting, and how that text, again, sort of creates this image of Charles I that then becomes sort of recycled and popularized and published in all of these different sort of cheaper editions across the period, and then responded to and satirized and sort of torn apart by Milton and iconoclasts. And that was really the reason I started with that moment, just because even as the Stuart sort of regime is collapsing, you have really Charles I sort of becoming more popular than ever before through the medium of print itself. And then that book I just found to be such a fascinating sort of portrayal of monarchy. And I don't know if you've read it, but it has this sort of like defense of these various things that Charles has done, right? And then each chapter ends with these sort of like prayers or meditations to God. So you get this like really intense portrayal of suffering kingship, I guess. And just despite the fact that the book was sort of treated as if it were an image, and a number of critics have sort of talked about this book as if, again, it was like trying to create this powerful image of monarchy that sort of overawed readers and overawed spectators and sort of converted them back to loyalism. I just sort of found that the visual elements from the frontispiece through the kinds of visual analogies used in the text hadn't been really fully explored to sort of like focus on what they're actually doing, what kind of relationship are they creating with readers, and how are they inviting readers to sort of interact with that text. So that was the logic of beginning with Charles. I just don't think you can find a more iconic representation of Stuart monarchy that's sort of so recycled across this period.
So that image, obviously, because a podcast is a great place to discuss
to talk about visual images.
Is this the one where the king is on his knees praying, and there's kind of beams coming out of his eyes into heaven, and beams from heaven coming to him, and it's very, very clear that he is being drawn as a martyr?
Yeah, absolutely. So he's kneeling, the Bible's open before him, right? He's sort of like, his crown has come off. He's like reaching for a crown of thorns, if I remember correctly. I should have the image in front of me. I don't. I have it with me now, I found it. And then there's these like sort of emblematic elements in the background, right? There's like a rock that's being beaten by waves. There's what else? Oh, palm trees that are like growing despite weights holding them down. And so it was really unpacking that image and trying to find, I think two things was one, and I came across this at the Huntington Library, and I don't know who was the creator of this file, but somebody, you know, somewhere, I think in the 18th century, had collected a bunch of William Marshall frontispiece engravings, and he's the engraver of the image. And so I happened to know when I was there on fellowship a number of years ago, I was looking through the box and I was like, oh, Marshall also engraved a few popular emblem books in the period, or at least the frontispieces for them. And so I was just trying to think about where he sort of came up with the imagery that he's using in this image. And that kind of led me to then start looking at some of these emblem books too and what they're doing. And so one of the big parts of this chapter or parts of this book is trying to think about, well, what do emblematics do when you incorporate them into the frontispiece? Like what kind of, like how are they asking readers to look at this book? And then I sort of look at the ways in which even visual imagery is used in these ways that are really analogous to how visual imagery functions in emblem books. It's kind of a way to like represent abstract meaning, but root it in sort of divine truth of the natural world. And so I think the image sort of sets up this kind of like pedagogical intent for the book, that somebody's to read this and it's not about like overwhelming them with this like sort of martyr king, but it's instead inviting them to that act of interpretation, to sort of see the truth of that portrayal of Charles and kind of see through all of these sort of partisan hypocrisies that are circulating. So I don't know it's hard to talk about this image when we're not able to all see it together. But
we will make sure that your cartoon is based on this image.
Excellent.
So it goes out. So.
That makes my day.
So we're looking. So this image is clearly fully invested in like the divine right of kings and stuff. But then obviously immediately after that, in your book, comes the interregnum and there is no king. And so how do we see this progress, this idea of portraying monarchy in print for people and trying to shape their perception of monarchy? Do we see evidence of a resistance to Cromwell through expressions of reverence for the concept of monarchy? And how do they change again when Charlie's boy comes back and takes the throne in 1660?
Yeah, So this isn't the kind of circulation of royalist images through the interregnum. It's not something I look at super closely in the book, outside of like thinking about how the Icon Basilica sort of circulates and is published. It becomes this runaway bestseller. But they did, right? I think is it Laura Knoppers who's written about this? But like images of Charles were not suppressed in the way that we might imagine them to be, despite, you know, sort of like more official images in terms of like statues or something being taken down, but in like, you know, sort of medallions and lockets and like cheap metals stamped with his image, and like even, you know, books like the Icon Basilica with this frontispiece, they circulated widely. And I think you're right, they helped sustain these sort of cultures of monarchism despite this sort of disruption to the monarchy. And they also help explain them to get to Charles II, who to me also is often much more of an interesting figure. I think they help explain that kind of groundswell of popular sort of outpourings of monarchism or royalism that you see at the Restoration, right? And just thinking through, you know, like the way, what is it, like 120,000 people came out to see him progress into London on his birthday in 1660, Charles II or something. And immediately, you know, there's banners and tapestries being put up. There's, you know, shop signs are being replaced with his image to celebrate his return. But then you get this sort of outpouring of a kind of commemorative consumer culture too, things like coronation ceramics, et cetera. And so I think that the possibilities of like sort of commercialized royalism really become sort of realized under Charles II. And that also coincides then in the third quarter of the 17th century, you have this rapid expansion of the engraving marketplace in London too, which is something that's really one of the places this book began, is just trying to sort of track, well, what does that do? What does the sort of increased ability to like represent especially portraits of rulers to a wider public, because portraiture sort of dominates the marketplace of engravings through the 17th century. What does that do to understandings of royal authority in the period? And I think that really coincides with Charles II's reign in particular, that expansion of the engraving marketplace. And even like really early in his reign, I mean, one of the most interesting things I had found was the engraver, is it Peter Stent, in like the early 1660s, is, you know, sort of like his catalog is published, and it's all of these various images of the royal family and those who orchestrated the Restoration too, that you can buy to kind of decorate your home with. But one of the things he also sells is like small little pictures of the royal family. And he says in this engraving catalog, you know, they're specifically for use to decorate tobacco boxes. So there's this impulse then, you know, not just to sort of acquire images of the royal family, images of Charles, but also to like incorporate them into personal possessions that you're then going to kind of carry around with you in public as, you know, a testament to your loyalty. So yeah, I'm super interested in that.
I love this. It's one of the things I love about this period so much, Stephanie, is when we talk about the early modern period, it feels like the Restoration years are the first time that we can actually recognize very, very well the world that we live in with mm-hmm. celebrity culture. And you know, Pepys writes about getting a lovely print of the Countess of Castlemaine for his house because he thinks she's lovely and he wants to look at her.
And multiple copies of that print too, right? I write about this in another short article that I wrote on like Frederick and like royal scandal, but I think it's like he gets multiple copies, but he actually goes to the studio to see the picture on the day it's finished. And then like yes. the day the engraving is published 4 years later, that's the day he's picking up.
It's like, yes, this is the one I wanted. And of course he writes about it all so beautifully, which gives us a hint. But we also get at this time, as the honeymoon period of the Restoration mm-hmm. starts to wear off a little bit, we get a certain amount of a lack of reverence towards those in power, satire and things like that. I mean, the Poor Horse Petition is my favourite, though it's not a direct attack on the monarch. Let's talk about the Popish plot in 1678, because this is a real moment that we get to see the lack of reverence to the monarch in print. Can you start off by just potting the Popish plot for our listeners?
Yeah, well, so absolutely. And I think the interesting thing too about this particular moment for me is that all of those issues that kind of plagued, you know, Charles I, like problems of religion, relationship between monarchy and parliament, those are the issues that then kind of come to the fore for Charles II, as you say, after 1678. And so, yeah, the Popish plot, kind of made up, right? to, like supposed design among Catholics in London to assassinate Charles II. It's unclear at first what they intend to do after they assassinate him. His brother will become king. So the Duke of York, who we now know is Catholic because of the Test Act, right, that he in 1673 had to resign his position in the Navy. And then, you know, there's going to be, as part of the plot, supposedly 20,000 armed Catholics will sort of rise up in London, start murdering Protestants. There'll be an invasion from the French and the Irish too. And yeah, so it's this, you know, sort of groundswell of anti-Catholicism sort of produces these intense anxieties. But the plot itself, and this is the thing that I mean, it's not really about this in my book, but this is the thing I just find so interesting, that it's really all the invention of Titus Oates and these three other plot informants. Yeah, and I mean, Titus Oates is this kind of like weird sort of like Anglican grifter who's accused of, you know, buggery in the Navy at one point, who then in like the mid 1670s, or is it like 76, converts to Catholicism. And then that's how he's carrying sort of letters between these like international centers of Catholicism, both in London and then on the continent. And that's how he claims to learn that this conspiracy exists. And so then he like heads back to London, and in I think it's August of 1678, he sort of tells the Privy Council and the king about it. And you can tell, I've read, I think it's Sir Robert Southwell, who's the clerk of the Privy Council, his notes are at the British Library. And you can just tell, I mean, they have to walk this really like fine balance between sort of showing that they're taking him seriously, because there is such intense anti-Catholic sentiment, but also like they clearly don't think this is real. And so they're asking for proof from Oates. He sort of sends some fake letters to the Duke of York's confessor, trying to trap him in a conspiracy. And so it's kind of going nowhere about the truth of this. And then what ends up happening is Titus Oates and this other sort of guy, Israel Tong, they sort of bring their accusations about the plot to the London magistrates, Sir Edmondbury Godfrey, who writes them down, and you know they publish them. But then he ends up dead. Like a week or two later, mm-hmm. and his body's found after he's been missing for a few days on Primrose Hill in London. So suddenly, this looks to some people like an actual conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And Oates is claiming that Sir Edmondbury Godfrey, right, was killed to try to keep knowledge of the plot from like escaping. So I think that's the most concise I can be, because it's such a weird sort of like moment, right? Where this fear of conspiracy and plots and sham plots really becomes endemic across the later 1670s and 1680s as a consequence. Oh, and then the only other thing to mention, right, is that
I'm so excited.
Yeah, well, because it then leads into this. My students, when I teach the Popish plot, they just get so excited too. And I'm always hoping somebody will write an essay on like who actually killed Sir Edmondbury Godfrey, because it's so confusing, yeah. Right? But anyway, this feeds into the campaign for exclusion, right? So this like the belief that there's a plot then moves leaders in Parliament, who we now would call Whigs, to try to exclude the future James II from the throne. And so that leads to further kind of political.
I mean, the modern equivalent of this, it, for anybody who's watching closely enough, is the Clinton body count, and how the death of, was it Vince Cape? I can't remember his name. The death of their close advisor was like, aha, you can see that this is now true. And then it escalates through the years through Pizzagate to QAnon. And it was like this one thing flipped a prejudice that was already there, and it just kept growing and growing and getting more and more credence. And
I think there's so much to that comparison. That's true too. So I think in this book, I mean, it's about early modern like English political culture, but it has these weird resonances with you know, like 21st century American politics. So I kind of began in this 2008 place, and when I was writing this chapter, it was just around the time of the 2016 election. suddenly we have and you can see it now, right? It's continuing, these like accusations of fake or false news, like concerns about political conspiracy and like secret forms of government that are undermining democracy. And I think the really interesting parallel for me when I was writing about the Popish bots was just that sort of fear that there were these sort of secret plots out there was really connected to media change for me. And so I was thinking about not just the expansion of the press, right, in 1679 when licensing temporarily lapses. So suddenly you get this outpouring of partisan news. And so like, you know, sort of events are then looked at from these, you know, two different vantage points that leads to these fears about conspiracy. But the other thing that I really think is so important was the invention of the penny post in 1680. Mm. And so, yeah, because what ends up, so the penny post, unlike the general post, it is very fast. It delivers letters within London, you know, within the day, potentially, depending on what time you drop your letter off. But you pay, when you drop the letter off, you pay your pennies. So it means that whoever is like the receiver of your letter is not paying for it, as traditionally is the case with the general post. So what it does is like so it's cheaper, it democratizes communication, but it also allows anonymous forms of like communication too. So for instance, you can target any political like leader, individual, writer with a penny post letter anonymously, and they're not going to know who's sending it to you. And so that fear of anonymous news also turns into a fear that, well, if I can target somebody, I could be targeted too. And you get this kind of pervasive trope in these different trials across the period related to the Popish plots of like, there are these sham conspiracies being invented and folks are using the penny post to implant, say, treasonous letters on like a true Protestant subject who's then going to get, you know, arrested and you know, convicted of treason or something against the king as part of this other sort of Catholic plot too. So that fear of, I don't know, the fears of anonymous circulation, the ways in which like those kind of standards of like trust and authenticity and credibility really become open to questioning. I think there's some really interesting parallels to now. Yeah.
How do we get to playing cards?
Yeah. So one of the things that I was really fascinated with was the invention of this sort of new ephemeral topical genre of engraved playing cards as part of this use of visual images to intervene in politics during this period of the Popish plot. And so the first pack of these cards is, I think it's in 1679, it's published and it's engraved by Francis Barlow. And pretty quickly, four different packs come out that same winter. And I think the use that, so these cards, what they do is they depict all of the different events in this Popish plot. They're not, and each card is engraved with an image. You know, for instance, like one image shows, I believe it's like Titus Oates, you know, when he's still a Catholic, like carrying letters between different centers of Catholic conspiracy, or you have an image of, you know, the assassin who's supposed to have shot Charles II when he was walking in St. James Park, like that's another image on these cards. But they're sort of difficult to work out what people are doing with them because, you know, they're the sort of events that lead or kind of comprise the Popish plot aren't presented in any kind of chronological order. The only sort of like order the cards seem to have is that the four main plot informants are the king in each suit in the pack, and like, which is traditionally the highest card, right, in any card game. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, what do people do with these? What kinds of political messages are they taking away from these cards? And so I was thinking about them too, in relation to like new kinds of card games and new ideas about gaming in the 1670s as well, where gaming is kind of moving from something that is being sort of morally criticized because it involves like, you know, the drawing of lots, right? Cards and dice, which then according to ideas of providence, God is kind of getting involved in these things. And so that's bad. And it moves from that to this, like, you know, sort of the emphasis on, you know, skill and probabilistic logic and rationality. And so that's happening at the same time too. And so, yeah, it was really difficult to work out, but what I think these cards are doing are engaging players or audiences who are looking at them in that act of narrating conspiracy. So they kind of each depict these discrete events in this history of, you know, Catholic plotting in England. And if they're read in the correct way, sort of how one card relates to the other, they add up to this kind of teleological bigger history of Catholic designs against, you know, England and the Protestant monarchy and Protestant rights and liberties. And so I think what they're doing, they're kind of like didactic or they're asking audiences then to kind of learn how to narrate conspiracy. So they're sort of like cultivating skepticism. They're asking you to like look closely, think about how one card relates to the next. So they're drawing upon those like, that, you know, sort of rationality, kind of logic, the same skills you would use in card play, but at the same time, they're, you know, adding up to this worldview where everything is, you know, governed by this broader teleology of conspiracy that really kind of it seems to be similar to this, like a kind of understanding of providence or something too, where everything kind of is always a sign of this much bigger system that, you know, kind of lies just beneath the surface of politics. And so, yeah, that's what I think they're doing, at least. I was really fascinated by these. And then eventually too, you know, other packs come out, you have more Tory leaning packs that are published, you know, a couple of years later, for instance. But they seem like this really novel way to kind of intervene in politics and to reach multiple sort of, you know, multiple audiences at different levels of the marketplace too, because they're just so cheap and available.
I mean, playing cards almost as a teaching aid is a wonderful thing. I have a reproduction set from 1676, which is it's counties of England, and you know, it's maps, and it they're almost like top trumps telling you, you know, how big the area is and how many people live there, and it's suggested that they were for children. So I like the idea of the kids playing cards and perhaps learning something.
There are some great sets at the Clark Library at UCLA. One of the best ones is it Joseph Moxon's set for, I can't remember if he's the one who designs it or not, but they're, I don't think he is, I think I got that wrong, but they're a set for like how to carve various kinds of meats even. Brilliant. So it's like, here's how you carve apart your lobster. But yeah, I think you're right. They are kind of pedagogical devices.
Yeah. Smaller than a book, keep it in your pocket, nice and convenient. I love this.
Well, and they really lend themselves to like group discussion too, right? You know, if you don't know how one card relates to the next, you can sort of talk to your neighbor about it who's playing cards with you.
And not just take all their money. So is there a sense after the sort of madness of the Popish plot and that late Restoration era, is there any sense that things calmed down following the Glorious Revolution in 1689 when William III comes to the throne? Mm-hmm. Does he offer the fact that we've now got this great Protestant king and his lovely Protestant wife and presumably lots of lovely Protestant heirs to follow, does that calm down the anti-Catholic press and things that are happening?
I mean, I think the short answer is no, in so many ways. And I'm just thinking, I mean, I have a sort of way that I might think about this from my book a bit. But I'm also thinking about Rachel Wheel's book, what is it called? A Plague of Informers, where she discusses ways in which this sort of plot-driven politics and fears about sort of securing the revolution settlement really sort of drive the state in that decade after the revolution. But so one of the things I do talk about or consider in my book is I try to think about how in 1695, print licensing lapses, and it becomes a permanent lapse to print licensing. So it ends pre-publication censorship within England. And that's really the thing that sets, you know, them apart from other major states in Europe. So for instance, France, but that you can print news without having it previously approved by the authorities. And this doesn't mean that, you know, the government doesn't try to regulate the press in other ways. We know that they do in the 18th century. Through like taxation, et cetera. But in 1696, there's an assassination attempt, or you know, a supposed assassination attempt against William, where he's supposed to be shot by some, I think it's Jacobite colonels as he's like going to Richmond. And this plot gets discovered. But what ends up, and this ends up leading to this kind of outpouring of loyalty and sort of like expressions of loyalty to Williamite state, which is really significant because Mary has died too, was it in 1694? So this is, you know, William, there's a lot of criticism of him, but this assassination attempt and what it kind of signifies ends up leading to this outpouring of, I think, sort of loyalist sentiment in favor of him. And one of the reasons is it happens, the assassination attempt in this, or news of it, sort of happens in this moment where there's this much more expansive print culture too. Mm-hmm. And print becomes part of the politics of the assassination attempt in this really interesting way. Because supposedly Louis XIV, and then also James II, so the Jacobite exile, that they supposedly, newspaper writers claim, were aware of the assassination attempt and had okayed it, which becomes this sort of like, oh gosh, how could, you know, this is just underhanded dealing that's, you know, not suiting of monarchs anywhere to agree to the assassination of another sitting ruler. But then what happens is newspapers, as they're writing about the attempt, as they're then like writing about these expressions of sort of loyalty that occur in the wake of it. So, you know, people taking the association oath and subscribing to it, declarations of like loyalist addresses that are being published for William that are then reprinted in London newspapers. What also ends up happening is newspapers say, well, this is how the story is being covered in the Paris Gazette. And they're claiming it's an entirely invented and fabricated attempt, that there was no assassination attempt, that this is just the government trying to secure this outpouring of loyalty for William. So what ends up happening then is like newspaper print and the freedom of the press in England actually becomes part of the debate in the wake of the assassination attempt, if that makes sense. So it seems to give, like writers are saying, like France is using print to enslave its subjects and support absolutism, but here our expressions of loyalty are authentic. And so even though, you know, like loyalist toasts and celebrations are always kind of manufactured by the local political elite, they're still, they have this kind of whiff of authenticity or kind of popular sort of loyalism and affection for the monarchy because of the fact that the press is not regulated by the government in England. So I think, yeah, these plot-driven politics do continue. There are still these fears about partisanship and sort of misrepresentation, but you also have print sort of working in this new way. And I think print for me really becomes this sort of vehicle for the cultivation of loyalist sentiment and for the sort of demonstration of that too, as, you know, sort of loyalist addresses are being reprinted from, you know, sort of from outside of London within London newspapers.
Got to ask as well. So we're talking about reverence for a monarchy. Charles II, let's just say that his behavior doesn't lend itself towards reverence, does it? How big a role do scandals have to play in the discussion about this during this period? Because he is completely indiscreet. And I think you write about Frederick, Prince of Wales's love life too, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel so, I'm definitely going to talk about Charles, but I hope somebody wants to work on Frederick and mistresses, because I think there's so much more work that could be done. But I think that's such a great question about how scandal kind of factors into these portrayals of monarchy. And I think, you know, for Charles, that sort of Mary monarch persona, you know, pursuing kind of libertine behaviors, and I think Kevin Sharp calls it a sort of politics of pleasure, I think in many ways was a response to the history of especially sexual sort of satires of the monarchy and politicians during the civil wars that are being printed. And also, I think it's a reaction to the fact that one of the big criticisms of his father is that he's sort of ruled by his Catholic wife, right? That Henrietta Maria is the one really calling the shots, and she's, you know, the sister of the French ruler. And so that she is somehow controlling those, like, sort of the strings of state or something. And so I think for Charles, if we see the way he's indulging, I mean, kind of almost an exhibitionist sexuality or something, It is this sort of reaction to the fact, I think, like the cat's out of the bag after that, just the history of civil wars and the ways in which, like, yeah, critiques of sex scandals have become part of this larger political critique. But also, I think it's this, I mean, he's sort of sending a signal, right? That he's not governed by his wife, that he's maintaining, I think, an independence, a sort of an ability to act beyond just his governance by her. And I think that's one of the interesting things for me. Yeah, when it comes back to that question of reverence, I think you're absolutely right. How do you square those things? The kind of over-familiarity that comes with these depictions of Charles' relationship with women at court and women outside of court, how do you square that with, you know, expressions of deference and obedience? It's a difficult thing to do. But to bring it back to Frederick, the thing I was really compelled by or interested in terms of his relationships with women, is, you know, so he has a pretty public mistress in the 1730s who I think doesn't get a lot of attention, Anne Vane, who is connected to a political family herself. And he has a couple of kids with her. They both eventually die. And then he takes public leave of her in 1736, just before he marries Princess Augusta. And I think he's using, just like kind of Charles used his relationship, Charles II, with women to kind of send a message. I think Frederick's doing something really similar, I think there's quite a lot of sort of leeway there, or people aren't super, although there is some criticism, it's not as pronounced because he's young, he's unmarried. You know, this is the kind of behavior aristocratic male youths indulge in, you know, drinking and relationships with women outside of marriage. But I also think, again, he's sort of using it to send a message about his independence. In this case, I think it's his independence from his family. He's being sort of kept under the thumb of George II and Queen Caroline. You know, he's like, doesn't have all of his household income. He's upset about that. He isn't put in charge of the regency whenever George takes his long trips to Hanover. And then at the same time, so he's kind of kept under the thumb, he's sort of denied this independence as a kind of political actor as the Prince of Wales. At the same time, George II is sort of popularly, or at least at court, criticized for somehow being like under the control of his wife, of Queen Caroline. So that same sort of criticism. So I think Frederick's sort of, you know, kind of creating a name for himself. People are interested in what he's doing. The scandals that are published about him, these sort of texts are not, they don't circulate super widely. They're actually fairly, you know, like sex always takes place off the page. They're not super pornographic or anything. And they allow him to sort of cultivate, I think, as part of his growing sort of persona, as part of his celebrity, that word he used before, almost a kind of, an independent persona outside of court, outside of his parents, and to attract sort of broader public attention as part of that. Did I answer your question? I can't, I feel like I've just...
it's just standard for History Hack. It's great. Yeah.
We love a tangent. We love it. Like,
seriously, our artist has just designed a mug with rabbit holes on it. So because we end up down them in every episode, don't we, Charlie?
We do. That's half the fun. I mean, yeah, we're moving out of my wheelhouse now, completely into the Georgian times. But seeing the attacks on Charles is, going after his authority based on the fact that he can't keep it in his trousers was just something that happened over and over again from the press and from within his court circle. But so long as he found it amusing, he would never clamp down on it because he just thought it was funny. He sent Rochester to the Tower a few times, send him away, come back, go and fight the Dutch for a while, Rochester, you've been naughty, come back again. It's just how he operated.
And I think that's such a great compare, because Frederick is doing like that, the level of sort of explicitness is never there in these, because I think Frederick's kind of like trying to embody this sort of popular Stuart sort of ruler already. Like he's kind of looking back to Charles as a model in a lot of ways.
I think he did, and that's so interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think there's so much more work that can be done on Frederick. I know there's a couple of folks who've been working on him, but just, yeah, his, the kind of identity he's creating for himself through, you know, sort of his public actions. So the other thing he does that I just find super interesting is he finally gets married. He's wanted to get married for a while. He finally gets married in 1736 to Princess Augusta, but after his younger sister has already gotten married. I mean, this is a kind of, I think, another example of those parental restrictions. But that marriage is so written about in the newspaper, and it's part of the kind of persona that's being created through the press for the early Georgians that I don't think we've thought about a lot, like how daily newspapers, even though the coverage isn't, you know, as gossipy or maybe quite as extensive as we'll see in late 18th century newspapers under George III, it's still there. I mean, the people are interested, like, oh, Frederick's launched a new pleasure barge on the Tees. Write about it. And then, like, when Augusta arrives, you know, he goes to Greenwich to greet her. And I think one of the newspapers is like, there's like 10,000 people that gathered to see him doing so, you know. And then, you know, when they finally do get back to, I think it's St. James on the eve of the wedding, it's either the evening before or the morning of, you know, they kind of pause in front of the windows so the crowds outside can stare at the two of them. And so they have this like ability to, I think, perform for the crowd. And I sort of see his relationship with his mistresses doing something similar, a kind of performance for the crowd, for these folks who are just, because of print, more interested in like monarchs as, and in the royal family as sort of people, as individuals who live these sort of interesting lives that folks want to know about.
Are there images shared widely as well in the press?
Yeah, I think, well, so the images are at, so this is a great question. You know, throughout at various moments when there are, you know, sort of like royal celebrations of some kind, coronations, processions, birthdays, that's when, or when certain individuals are in the news, that's where you'll see, yeah, more images being advertised and coming out across this period. And the kinds of things that are being produced, so for, I think it's George II's coronation, you know, folks in newspapers are selling, you know, an image of the procession, the coronation procession, actually printed on silk scarves that you can then wear while you're sort of renting out of feet to watch them possess with the city. So yeah, their images are becoming, I do think, more ubiquitous and cheaper, more available too. Yeah. And also the other side of this is that, you know, there are changes in technologies of engraving in the later part of the 17th century. So one of the new techniques is mezzotint engraving.
Yes, thanks Prince Rupert for that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Somebody knows about the origin story of mezzotint, that Rupert is the one who sort of supposedly like brings it back and demonstrates the technique for the Royal Society. Oh. But yeah, so mezzotint, the good thing about it, because you're kind of working from dark to light, so you sort of rub out the areas of the plate that will print lighter, and you're not sort of engraving with these, like, you know, lines and cross hatches like you would be with line engraving. It's much quicker, so it better reproduces the surface of a painting. So you actually get, you know, a really kind of gorgeous surface that reproduces even what look like the brush strokes of an original painting that's being copied. But at the same time too, you can produce a plate much more quickly. I can't remember the exact time, but it's much more quickly than line engraving, which then allows you to better respond to consumer demand. So if somebody wants a portrait of somebody, or, you know, to go back to your example of Pepys, you know, you're not gonna be waiting for years for William Faithorne's engraving of Catherine. You're gonna get it much, much more quickly as a consequence of changes in engraving technologies. Yeah.
This is mad because I do George V and I've got mass press and that he's just being paparazzi to death. So like so far out of my wheelhouse. It's great.
But yeah. I think that's, but you've got the origins of that kind of interest, I think, going back to this earlier period. That's the thing that's so good. Because we've thought about, especially George I and II is just not being very popular, not like folks not kind of really being interested in them, you know. And I think too, we kind of see this big break when it comes to cultures of loyalism and monarchy kind of across the revolution. And instead, I think what we're seeing here is this like much longer kind of flexibility of conservative political thought of monarchism kind of across the 17th into the 18th century. And that part of that flexibility comes from, you know, the expansion of the press, the expansion of the, you know, consumer political culture. Yeah.
So association with royalty for any business, any producer, right from then until now is good for business, right? And you get businesses competing to supply the king. The king in turn being perhaps encouraged to wear British. I'm thinking about, all I can think now is just Kate Middleton and championing British designers like Diana did before her, how does that association and wanting to be loved and wanting to be championed by the monarch, how does that get squared with fascination for scandal?
And just before you start, I have to laugh. That's your association. Mine is seeing the Waitrose van come into Windsor Castle from the Royal Archives with a stamp on the side of it to deliver the Queen's shopping.
Lovely. She's doing well. She's got Waitrose coming.
Definitely. She don't do Tesco's.
Well, I think this is such a good question. And I mean, I don't know that I have a definitive answer for how, yes, scandal kind of gets squared with consumer culture and commercialization, sort of. But you do see, just as you're describing, I think both of these examples, the Kate Middleton example and the Waitrose bag example, you see kind of precursors to that in the period that I'm looking at. And so a couple of things that come to mind are, sort of surrounding the wedding, is it in 1734, of Princess Anne and Prince William of Orange. There's an engraving produced sort of showing, the court at the wedding. There are these long descriptions of the, these are the shoes folks are wearing. This is how they're wearing their hair, entirely English, of course. This is the, they're wearing silks that are, sort of large floral silk patterns that we know from other folks' work are incredibly popular in the 1730s. And of course, they're all the product, the product of, the native London silk industry. So there's that same sense of, buying English, buying British, that's already happening, especially because of that competition with France when it comes to something like silk or luxury production. But then you also, I think, to like the Waitrose bag example, I have some work on sort of folks who chose to operate under royal shop signs in London in the 18th century. And some of these folks who are like choosing to operate under, the sign of the Prince of Wales, or choosing to operate, under the sign of Queen Caroline or Queen Charlotte, that they have an official position as, providing something to the monarch, like lace maker, et cetera, to the royal family. So there is that sort of sense that they are distinguished because of it, and that becomes part of their own sort of advertising. But not always, and not exclusive, like by no means is that, always the case. Lots of folks just like to operate under shop signs to sort of specify their political loyalties even. And I have this other sort of example I came across in the early 1720s of these, like a high church and a low church cheesemonger. of all things. And the low church cheesemonger, he has set up a sign of George I, I believe it is. That's the sign he's operating under. And then one night his sign gets targeted and it gets destroyed. And it turns out it's, related to the fact that he was involved in giving evidence against somebody else, or somebody gave evidence against him in a trial. And that it's this competition between these two cheesemongers, and it's a signification of his political viewpoints, like sort of supporting dissent and supporting the Georgians. Even your choice to use these images, even in a commercial setting, can be politically meaningful. How that squares with scandal, I think is an interesting question that I haven't thought as much about.
That is so interesting. That you choose where you support with your money, don't you? It's like you pick your cheesemonger based on your political your political opinions.
I've never had a cheesemonger, so I don't know if
it's kind of like us all stropping last week on Twitter with Charlotte Tilbury, because she decided to tell us all that the way to a happy marriage was to never let your man see you without your makeup on. And our instant response was, I ain't ever buying her son in makeup ever again. She can do one.
Mm-hmm. And we won't drink in Wetherspoons ever again either. But no, British people, we do have a cheesemonger. Stephanie, we all have one.
And we all choose. It's really competitive as well.
They're very political.
You just can't get in with the fashionable cheesemonger. Actually, Charlie, this next question. Yesterday, we went nuts at Westminster Abbey over those little peep shows. They were little optical illusion images of Queen Victoria's coronation. And you've also looked at how images connected to royalty can be found in the home. What have you discovered in that area?
Yeah, I want to see these peep shows because I haven't seen
them. Don't Google.
I will get it out of the box, but I will just.
That's amazing. Yeah,
well, I'll edit this bit out.
Travel to London again. I feel like the pandemic has just interrupted all research. Oh, that's incredible.
Okay, let me know if you can. So you.
Oh, I can sort of. Yes, I actually can. Holding up to the camera works. Oh, that's incredible. You're kind of, it's an immersive experience of,
so it feels like you're looking down the whole abbey instead of just looking at a picture of the abbey. Well, our listeners are now going, I want to see the peep show.
Yeah, please do not Google Victorian peep show, just don't.
You would end up with some not safe for work search results. but I actually, so I think that's such a great parallel. So that the thing you've just shown, like it sort of, you look inside the little viewfinder there and you can sort of see the Victorian coronation sort of in three dimensions. And it's so hard to try to uncover how folks in, late 17th and early 18th century England actually looked at images of kings and queens and the kind of things those images conveyed. It's so like the kind of politics of the gaze is it surrounds that act of looking is such a difficult thing to uncover. In my book, I tried to draw upon some of the kind of theoretical discussions of the gaze. So, Louis Morin's work on absolutist visual culture and the way it's supposed to kind of subjugate the spectator. You sort of observe the image of, Louis XIV, the Hyacinth for God image, almost as if you're looking at the actual king. You're made aware through that image, it sort of produces the king's absolute power and you're made aware of your status as his subject. And there are just so few discussions in England of what it's like to look at one of these sort of especially cheap images of the king or queen that sort of find their way, into your home and you put them in your dining room, for instance, which is the place evidently you're supposed to hang.
Well, it's the plates. There's a British obsession with the commemorative plates.
Well, and that begins in this period, sort of various potters are producing, ceramics with images.
I have a whole collection of ceramic mugs from George V's funeral.
That's incredible.
Coronation, sorry. Yeah, like matching, they're all pen pots and stuff. But we are obsessed with royal tat in this country. I bought some yesterday. I am entirely guilty of it.
Well, this is how I, when I talk about my project, when I used to share what I did with students, that's how I would always introduce it. Like, have you been to London? Have you been to one of these tourist areas? Have you walked into a souvenir shop? And like, I was like, I'm looking at the origins of that in the 17th century. But how folks actually looked at these is such a hard thing to really gauge, especially since there are very few records of what they did. Even when people were traveling like country houses to look at, sort of art and sculpture in the 18th century, they might just write like, good, great. not necessarily these long, lengthy engagements. But one of the passages that I feel like I get a lot of use out of in my book, it comes from this treatise on Japanning by George Stocker and John Parker. And it's published in, 1688? And Japanning is essentially an imitative art in which you sort of lacquer wooden furniture or other things with a sort of shiny surface and often will include sort of chinoiserie images when you're doing it. So the whole treatise is like, well, how do you make these? And it's like, who is this for? And they sort of say, we're publishing for the, the gentry who are interested in what good Japan is. But one of the sections of that book actually deals with, well, what do you do with engravings in your home? How can you display them? And they suggest in particular for mezzotint that you can color it and glaze it with a kind of lacquer and then place it on your wall. And they describe that process of like, what it's like to look at that lacquered picture of the king. And they describe it as like, here the prince and subject may and not irreverently meet face to face. here I may approach my king without the introduction of a courtier. And that idea that like somebody's going to see that image of, say, Charles II or, you know, William III and actually imagine they have an audience with the real king in some way, which reminds me of the Victorian Peep Show you brought up, that kind of immersive experience. And I just, so one way of answering the question is just to think about, well, these, you know, a reflection like that and how even something that was cheap and sort of ephemeral might have had this, you know, like major significance for an individual if sort of hung within the home. And then the other sort of part of that question is so many of these images, because they were inexpensive and because they were ubiquitous, you know, they're just not preserved. So going back to that Peter Stent, you know, images on tobacco boxes, you're actually doing something with that image. You're glazing it on like a tobacco box you're going to carry around, which means that's going to get lost. It's going to get damaged. It's not going to end up in a museum. And so like a lot of these kinds of things, because they were inexpensive and quotidian, they're just not available. So it's just so difficult. But one of the things I'm sort of arguing is that by incorporating the state into and the monarchy into these sort of domestic interiors, that's really the significant thing here. It's making the monarchy kind of part of the effective attachments and intimacies that are formed within the home. And that becomes a sort of site for the cultivation of loyalty, for the cultivation of, you know, sort of loyalty imagined as an emotional bond with the ruler in some way, like imagined through that language of affection and affect. But yeah, I also love royal kitsch. I've got a lot of it that I've got at the tops whenever I'm in London on research.
Stephanie, you could have taken this book up right to the modern day, and you know, Alex and I and our portraits in the house. You probably can't see, but over my shoulder in my hall there, there's a portrait of Charles II.
Yeah, I'm having pictures everywhere in this house.
We're having audiences with those long dead kings every day.
Well, having worked for the civil service, you still walk past a portrait of the Queen every day on the way into your office. There's a portrait in every office still.
There you go. But your book ends in 1760. You haven't gone through to these two nerds today. Is there a greater degree of reverence in 1760?
So I don't think there's a greater degree of reverence. And so for me, reverence is really defined when we look back at sort of discussions of it in like sermons and political treatises. It's really defined as the kind of demonstration of deference in some way. It's a kind of outward looking thing that you perform and show reverence. And it's also not just, it's not servility, right? That's the kind of difference between, you know, having kind of constitutionalist monarch or and a kind of absolute, right? This is voluntary, yeah. The kind of reverence that you show. And so I think like that idea that that's what reverence is kind of remains consistent. But for me, the change I see is that increasingly across this period, there's that greater emphasis on deeper levels of feeling in some way, that it's not just about that outward performance, but it's the sort of feeling of some kind of emotional bond. And there's that, you know, increased understanding of loyalty through that language of emotion and affection demonstrated for the ruler in some way, or sort of experienced or felt for them. So I think for me, that's the change. And you know, we might see it as a kind of domestication of monarchy in some way. Like this is, you know, I think of it as kind of double-edged sword or something, where you have on one side, you know, images and print are making the royal family, even while they're sort of inaccessible to most, they're becoming more familiar. And that familiarity might breed, you know, criticism or contempt. But at the same time, I think it breeds the possibility of a kind of intimate association with them, that you can imagine yourself kind of having this sort of personal bond with the individual of the ruler. And so I think that's the change I see, the increasing sort of shift toward loyalty understood through the language of affection and emotion in particular, and kind of cultivated through the expansion of print, both visual and textual. And so I think, again, this is about the flexibility of conservative political thought across the 18th century. I think that's the thing I sort of keep coming back to, that you have, again, that emphasis on obedience, but also this kind of material sort of proof of these emotional bonds that are being created through the images and objects that you, you know, have in the home and carry about, you know, on your person.
Stephanie, thank you so much for coming and sharing that with us. It's incredibly fascinating. And again, so much that we see and still experience today. This is just the foundations of it. So thank you for sharing them with us.
Thank you for having me on. This was so great to revisit my book and have a nice chat about it with you too. I really enjoyed it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.